format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Laura.
Hi, my name's Laura. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks so much for having me. I want to thank Rachel for asking me to speak, and all of you for being here, and I want to wish everybody a happy Valentine's Day. I was kind of hoping that no one would be here, but I actually, about 20 minutes ago, looked up, and my 2-year-old was handing me a rose, and my husband had stopped by, before bedtime, and I just... Gifts of sobriety. Anyway, so I'm always curious about people's stats, so I'll give mine. My sobriety date is March 8th of 2010. I was 10 days before my 30th birthday. I was 29 on the day of my last drink. I have a sponsor. Her name is Tika. I think she's an angel. And, the last 7 years have been it just keeps getting better and better. And when I got to AA, I think my attitude was kind of like, I don't think alcoholism's a thing. And if it's a thing, I don't have it. And I tumbled into AA in 2006. I was referred by the medical community. There were a lot of people in my life that thought I should probably stop drinking, and I was not one of them. And I was pretty young the first time someone suggested to me that my drinking was unusual. I remember distinctly sometimes that my father did it. And I didn't really see it. And interestingly enough, I qualified for several years in AA saying that my first blackout or my first drunk, I was like a freshman in college or something. And then my mom told me that when I was 13 in Europe at my grandparents' neighbor's garden party, I apparently drank so much wine that like I got sick and had to be taken home. And my grandfather asked my mom, like, what's wrong with Laura? So that reminds me that I don't even know my own story, you know, but it also shows that I probably didn't drink normally from the beginning. But when I got to AA, I thought I'd been a social drinker for lots of, you know, years and that I'd been kind of doing okay, which was really not true. So I don't know, the way that I drank. I danced on a table during that first blackout freshman year of college. And, towards the end of my drinking, I was living with a guy I had taken hostage, and he used to say to me in the mornings, you know, you said this last night, you did this, and I was like, I did not do that. And he threatened to record me. He was like, next time I'm going to record you. So one day we had, we'd gone down to Florida to spend some time with his folks, and I always used to get really wasted, like the night before we had to go do anything like that. And I never realized it was because I was really nervous about the trip. But traveling was always a disaster. And we were on our way, we were flying home, and we were traveling with like a little puppy. And it had been a stressful trip, mostly because we were like fighting a lot, and I was a disaster. And I turned to him on the flight, totally not caring that we had like this dog and all these bags. And I was like, I'm going to get drunk now. It wasn't like I'm going to order a beverage, you know, like... But that's what I said, and I did that with spectacular efficiency. And we were taking a cab home, I think, from JFK or LaGuardia, and I had already blacked out at this point, and he turned on his, like, video voice recorder or whatever on his iPhone and recorded 45 minutes of what I was like, you know, including getting home and berating him and going out on the balcony and smoking cigarettes. And I was really, really awful. And when he played this audio recording for me in the morning, I didn't think, you know, like, that's, you know, next time you pick up a drink, that's what you're going to turn into. My only concern was, like, delete the evidence. I was like, you need to delete that, like, immediately. But, yeah, I was not a very nice drunk by the end, at least. Earlier on, I think I might have been fun, but... So I tumbled in here in 2006 in connection with a hospitalization. It was actually my first one. But I was really, really sick, and I really didn't know it. And I remember that I was in a 72-hour psych ward, psych hold at Bellevue, while they tried to figure out what to do with me. I had also, like, taken a bottle of pills, because my best thinking at the end of that night was that. You know, I didn't know how to pick up the phone and say, this is what's going on with me, this is what I'm doing. Like, that was not a part of my skill set. And I was supposed to be at work, you know, so... The doctor looked at me and was just like, this chick has no idea how sick she is. So they told me they were going to commit me. And I was like, oh, give me the paperwork, I'll sign. Because I happened to know it was harder to get out if you were involuntarily committed. So I went and spent about, I think, 3 to 5 days, I can't remember, a few days, pretending that I worked there and, like, alphabetizing the movies and acting like it was, like, all a big mistake. You know, I, like, had this really important job I had to get back to. Anyway, they referred me to AA, or I thought, I was all about, like, don't you know who I think I am? And so I audited AA a little bit back in 2006, and I was convinced it wasn't for me, and I went back out for 2 years to prove that I could not drink normally. And I had this repertoire of bad stuff that happened when I drank, and my last night of drinking was by no means my worst, but, you know, I just added something new that I didn't ever want to do again. And it was a Sunday morning, and I sat on my bed, and I thought, how many more times do I have to prove it to myself? You know, how many more times do I have to show that this is what happens when I drink? You know, those people were right. So I called some numbers that I still had in my phone from, you know, 3 or 4 years earlier, and one of them picked up, and I came back. And when I was here in 2006, I was not interested. You know, people talked about sponsors and commitments, and I really felt sorry for you guys, and I was like, I'm not interested in doing any of that. When I came back in 2010, I was so willing. You know, I was just so tired, and it just felt like my life had derailed so completely, you know. And I had a great family, but they were really not that thrilled with me and not talking to me that much. And I had a great education, and I was literally emotionally unequipped to use it. You know, I couldn't apply it. And I was just really sad, and I couldn't sleep, and I was just really very unhappy. And the medical community was like, we don't know what's wrong with you. Are you depressed? Are you bipolar too? Are you borderline? You know, I went through all kinds of medications in my 20s. Since I worked the steps, I have not taken any prescription medication other than prenatal vitamins. I don't know how many of you guys can see, but I'm almost 7 months pregnant up here. Anyway, so I came back and I asked somebody for a recommendation for a sponsor. And I got 2 phone numbers, and my sponsor, you know, almost 7 years later, is the first one of those 2 women who called me back. And we met once a week, and she took me through the book. And looking back, there probably were tons of women who would have been willing to guide me the way that she did. But until I was ready to do it, you know, she was the one who was there. And I really owe her my life, you know. I just don't understand how a life can transform that quickly, you know. And when I sponsor women, you know, I just... It doesn't take that long to see, you know, where on that spectrum of willingness we fall. And I just know that the ones who, you know, show up having done whatever we talked about, the writing or whatever, their lives change so fast, you know, and, like, just so much for the better. And, you know, there was such a low correlation between what I said I was going to do and what I actually did when I came in, you know. And, like, so for the ones who call and tell me why they can't make it, or the ones who don't, you know, like, it doesn't, it's almost like, you know, you can just see the disease and separate it from the person, you know. And I got in my own way, like, all the time. And I still call my sponsor almost every day, and there's very little, if she suggested I ought to do it, that I wouldn't do. And I don't know why that is, you know. My best friend from college died of this disease at 33. I was 5 days home from my honeymoon when I got the phone call. And, you know, it wasn't even one of those deaths where, like, you wouldn't be sure. Like, if I died from those pills I took, people wouldn't even have been sure it was alcoholism. She had been, like, drinking in her apartment, had an enabling boyfriend who was bringing her booze, came home, found her unconscious. She got to the hospital, spent 5 days alive on life support, and then her organs gave out. Like, she drank herself to death. And that's totally the kind of person that I partied with, you know. And I know that, you know, if you partied with me, you probably have a shorter than average life expectancy. I know that without AA, I do. And I'm really, really grateful to be here. And I remember when I reached out to her to try to make an amends, and she sounded audibly intoxicated. She said, I tried AA, I finished it. And I heard that, and I heard the tragedy in that, because, I mean, I think from the reaction I just got, I know you guys, a lot of you understand, like, we don't finish AA, you know. It's a daily thing, and I know that without it, my alcoholic mind will lead me straight back to a drink. Like, there is no doubt in my mind anymore. I used to not understand that, but, you know, alcoholism's in the cells of my body. I think it's maturing with me. So I'm crazy if I think I know what'll happen if I put alcohol in my body 7 years later. But that mental part, you know, like the way we connect here, you know, and the prayer and the meditation and the putting ourselves in the lives of others in a way that really guarantees emotional development, you know, it's just, it's absolutely unbelievable. And I was not a religious or spiritual person when I got here. And the fact that, you know, I feel connected to all of you guys and grateful for my life is just a miracle. So I don't have another word for it. Anyway, I'm really grateful for my sobriety, and thanks for listening.
Our second 10-minute speaker is John.
Thanks. Hey, everyone, I'm John, an alcoholic. Hey, happy Valentine's Day. Stats. My sobriety date is 9-8-10. My sponsor is Sarah L. I sponsor a gaggle of really great guys, and my home group is the Saturday Beginners Group. Downtown every Saturday, 10:30 a.m., 16th and 3rd. Y'all come on down. You know, in that little, like, scan I just did, I, like, look around. Because I like to look at all your faces, you know. I like to see what we look like. You know, like, what do we look like? And we, so many of us look so shiny and smiley and, you know, I'll just say happy. And I always wonder how we got there. Because I'm one of those people, right? Like, I'm so, like, I smile a lot, you know. I smile a lot, and it bugs some people, but I just can't help it. And in all seriousness, I stand here with you guys today, and I'm so grateful for this group for letting me come and speak tonight. Thank you. I just wanted to say that. But, you know, I stand here, a 33-year-old, proud gay man who loves himself, is able to love you all, help people recover from this, like, deadly, deadly, very misunderstood, as we heard from this last qualification, disease, mental illness. And I am able to be of real usefulness to my friends, my family, my community. Oh, and like that, what you just heard, like that is all AA. Because once upon a time, not long ago, I was a disaster. And, I hated you. I really hated myself, which just would manifest in me hating you. You know, I accidentally got sober. That's how I say, like, I was 19 when I started this journey, and I had what I now know is a moment of grace, which then was dressed up as a moment of fear. I was scared. I was a professional party boy by the age of 19, and I was, like, really done. And I just got really scared one day, and I called my folks back in Texas, and I was like, hey, I'm scared. I have a real problem here. With substances. And, I come from a really loving, warm, like, non-alcoholic household. I think it's important for me to say that also. Like, I still wound up here, and I had, like, a super lovely childhood. So these lovely folks of mine, like, snatched me up. I was on a plane, like, the next day. I didn't even have time to, like, throw a proper goodbye party, which I did throw one, mind you. At that goodbye party, I drank a big old tall boy of Budweiser. I hate Budweiser, but it was what was there, so, you know, I drank it. That's my last drink, big old ugly thing of Budweiser. And then I got on a plane and I went to rehab, totally, totally oblivious to the fact that I was an alcoholic, and I did not want to be an alcoholic. I wanted to drink so bad. I wanted to drink and be a normal person, and I surely was not. And it took me a really long time to accept that fact. Because I only have 10 minutes, I'm just gonna, like, I went through rehab, quasi accepted that I was an alcoholic, and I knew that if I drank, bad things happened. I didn't like AA. I wasn't ready for AA for whatever reason. It's because I wanted to drink. I know that now. I wanted to be normal. I didn't want to come to meetings. I didn't want to do any steps, and I didn't want to talk about God, and I surely didn't want to sponsor anybody. So like I did my own thing, and I didn't go to meetings. I think at like 6 months, I was like, I'm out. Oh, I'm out. The desire to drink and do drugs was lifted from me. And, I was like, well, that's it. I'm going to do my thing. I took a hostage. I went back to school. I, like tried to just do like my own thing. Cut to, almost 8 years of sobriety, meaning like no meetings, no booze, no nothing, just me and my mind and this poor hostage and our two dogs and things. And my failing career. And I picked up. And I was so shocked. Shocked. Because I thought I was going to be one of those people that would never. I thought I had, like, beat the system somehow. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. It was such a beautiful, clear component of a step one for me, which I could not identify prior, which is why I didn't really do this work. I had no solid step one. This was very clear to me. You know, I have this mind that tells me, in my case, once every couple years, like, try it, it'll be different. Try it, you're fine. And I have this allergy that once I start, I'm not entirely sure what's going to happen to me. And at this time in my life, I had no defense because I was like spiritually bankrupt. Nothing. There was nothing between me and like this like drink that was just like, here we are. So there I was, and just like dumbfounded, completely baffled. And a friend of mine had gotten sober really recently, one of my best friends actually. He took me to GMHC, and it was a Tuesday night, and I just was ready. You know, I sat down and I just like started listening to you folks, and I just had a shift, and it was like the first of very many shifts in this program. One could say that was like my very first spiritual awakening, just like a shift in the way I think about things and people and myself. And I got a sponsor who is here tonight. She's now one of like my closest friends. She whipped me through those steps. I got like two service commitments. Some guy asked me to start sponsoring him when I had like 80 something days. My sponsor said, you better do it. And that means you really better start doing your steps a little bit faster. Thanks for that. So that's what I did, and I recovered in this lovely, beautiful, really fast way where, like, my life just, like, totally flipped around. And I've worked the steps a couple times since then, and I just have so much to say about AA. I have so much to say about my process of, like, how I got from, like, that punk, I hated you, to like somebody who really loves you. Like I don't know a lot of you because I don't attend this meeting. But you know, I love you. You know, I know you. If you walked up to me afterwards and needed anything, if I could do it, I would do it. That's AA. And I can tell you one of the major ways I got to like this place is I did the steps that are in this book, to the best of my ability. And I just said yes a lot. I took a lot of opposite actions when I didn't want to do things. I just did it because I don't know any better. You know, that's a third step thing, to turn over everything I think I know, just like, and do something else. My something else looks a lot like what's in AA. That might not be the same thing for you, but for me, my something else is AA. And it works for me, you know. Today, I'm like really solidly happy. Things happen in life that are totally bad, and I don't understand them, and I don't know how to cope with them. But I'm never afraid of that, you know. I'm never really afraid that I'm going to be dropped. I have that round-the-clock faith that's talked about in the big book where, like, I know that I'm taken care of no matter what. That kind of like deep, non-religious, just like faith in something higher than myself that I'm going to be taken care of, I can't explain that, you know. a lot of us have our own individual views about what that means. But for me, my first sponsor, she gave me this analogy when I was like crying in Times Square. I'll end you on this little story. Crying in Times Square, I have like a handful of days, and I'm like, Teresa, I don't know how to do anything. I'm freaking out. I'm my life, and I'm just like totally going through it. My life is in shambles, as we are when we first come in. And she said, John, listen, like, you've taken a leap of faith. You've like jumped off this huge ledge. And at the bottom, if you ever do hit the bottom, are these big giant hands. She put her hands out like this. She's like, and at the bottom, that's God. God's got you. So like, enjoy the free fall. The best thing that has almost anybody has ever said to me, I take it with me to this very day. So, I hear things like that all the time from you folks. So my heart is with you. I'm so grateful. Thank you so much.
And our main speaker tonight is Sarah.
Thank you. Great. Good. Hi, everybody. My name is Sarah. I'm an alcoholic. Absolutely wonderful to be here. It's Valentine's Day, a time to be with your true love, or at least one of them. And I am unabashed in saying that AA is certainly a true love of mine. There is no place I would rather be than here. And one of the great advantages of having lead time, which I did thanks to Randy and Ava, was a chance to think a little bit about the trajectory of my sobriety. Because quite honestly, it's not often that we get to speak for as long as I'm going to be privileged to share with you tonight. And my home group is the Promises Meeting, the original one that takes place on Fridays at 12:30. And because I've been going there ever since it started in the mid-80s, I realized that the promises are sort of baked into my sobriety the same way as the steps are. And so when I was thinking about coming here tonight, I was reflecting that much of my experience, strength, and hope is trapped between the second and the fourth promise. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. We certainly hope so. And we shall not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. So it occurred to me, out of the blue, the way we get these flashes in sobriety, that 6 months before I stopped drinking, before I was 12-stepped into Alcoholics Anonymous, I got a whopping case of alcoholic poisoning. At the time, I did not know what this was called. I just thought it was really bad. And I had been on a 10-day marinade in Europe. And I got back to New York, and within a matter of hours, I was flat on my back, on the floor, unable to keep down even a teaspoon of water. And this was really awful. When I recovered, and I was walking around a little shaky, I thought, my God, that was really terrible. I better do something to change that. I stopped smoking on the spot. Cold turkey, after 20 years, I never picked up another cigarette. And I used to think that was very resourceful and inventive because I had not stopped drinking. And then as I got sober over the years, I realized that that was a very telling moment for me. Like so many of us, it never occurred to me to stop drinking. But the denial that that little episode showed me about myself was also a key to what I think is so important for me in my story, which is related to something somebody said to me early on. Sarah, we wouldn't need denial if we didn't have awareness. And somehow, in that moment, in that January bereft moment, 6 months before my anniversary, which is actually Bastille Day in July, I understood something about my responsibility for myself. Yes, I stopped smoking. That was good. No, I did not stop drinking. That was not so good. But I began to make the connection that it was up to me. And that opened the door to a kind of willingness, which for me, because I believe that it was God's grace that got me sober when it never occurred to me to give up what was the glue, the fun, the everything in my life, that it was a little window of grace that opened for me and coincided with my willingness to see what was there. And over the course of the next 6 months, when I went back to the tropical island where I was living and bottoming out, and yes, Peggy, living with a pirate, Peggy and I spoke together in San Antonio in 2015, and she chided me tonight, Sarah, yes, we know your story, and are we going to hear about the pirate? And yes, at the end of my drinking, I was living the dream on a tropical island with a pirate, halfway between a palm tree and a piña colada. I thought it was just heaven. But in fact, I had given up the job that I had gone there to take some years before, which was the best job on the island, for the simple reason that I could not hold a drink in one hand and a job in the other, so I did the only obvious thing, gave up the job. And then I began that unbelievably unstoppable careening to disaster end of my drinking, which took, well, it was happening for a few years, but it really was precipitated by removing the control of having to get up and go to work. And I think about the woman who 12-stepped me who used to say to me, Sarah, most alcoholics, when they wake up after a bad night, if they were anybody other than an alcoholic, they would go to the emergency room. We go to work. And that was certainly true. So true for me. So part of my reflection in the embrace of those bookends around the past and not regretting the past led me to think about how on earth did I get here? How on earth did I get here? And they say that there are three kinds of people in the world. The kind who make things happen, the kind who watch things happen, and the kind who say, what on earth happened? And I started out in life really as committed to the make things happen. I was born here in the city. I grew up in the suburbs. I had a loving family. I was the second oldest, but the first girl, which meant I was pink and special. And the world in the 50s, if any of you remember that or saw it on TV, was very different. It was a much smaller, safer world. And people were really happy and felt no reason to apologize for it. And those of us who weren't so happy, it took another 10 or 15 years until we went into therapy to realize that maybe we weren't so happy. But it was a kind of sweet and innocent time. And just to put a little punctuation on it, in those days, something digital referred to your fingers or toes. A mouse was something you did not want to see in your kitchen. And an apple was something you ate. It was before social media. Although it was not before social drinking, which a friendly alcoholic described to me as getting drunk with other people. Not exactly the thing. But that was my world. And even though there were things about my upbringing and my community and all of that that were a little inconsistent, the one thing that was sure was to me was that if I were an achiever, preferably an overachiever and a star, then I would be okay. And in my family, which was kind of funny, I loved my family dearly, but my father had grown up in New England, sort of hardscrabble poor, and he had become a success, but he was really driven by keeping up with the Joneses. And my mother, who had come from the South, from the founding family of a small town, was pretty sure we were the Joneses. So between the two, I was sort of a little bit uncertain about how the world was going to function. So I just set about being the best I could at everything. And I see nodding heads, so I know I'm not the only one. And I think as alcoholics, one of my early sponsors said to me, "Sarah, alcoholics are just like everyone else, only more so." And I found that to be absolutely true. And as I have stayed sober and known so many people in the rooms, our personalities, our charisma, our brains, our charm, our talent is just enormous. And I think that sometimes we have an extra dose of all of that because we very nearly lost everything. Certainly I did. And so my striving to be a star really protected me from the early onset that you have heard about tonight of people who really, at a very tender age, were candidates to be here. I was just blazing through life, and interestingly, when I was a child, a memory that I did not remember until I was sober, just about the first time anybody ever asked me, as a little tiny girl, what did I want to do when I grew up? Thank you. Without hesitating, maybe I was five, I don't know where this came from, I looked at the grown-up and I said, "I want to be a missionary." And then in a flash, somehow I knew that missionaries did not get to go to parties or wear pretty dresses. And I said, "No, I mean a movie star." And in fact, the concept behind both of those things really guided my life and a lot of my alcoholism, because when I finished my excellent education, I worked for the public good, but I did it in very glamorous, party-filled settings. And because I was a burgeoning alcoholic, I loved to party, John, and I've always felt that if you want a good party, you ask someone who loves to go to them to make it happen for you. So I was naturally a good party giver, and that helped me in my career. And as I may or may not have mentioned along the way, I became a gifted drinker. I had an enormous capacity. Once I started drinking, sort of at the end of college, a late bloomer I was, but I wasted no time. And I am one of those alcoholics who had a lot of fun behind certainly the early years of my drinking. New York was a great place to be drinking, and there was lots of adventure and excitement, and it was all there for the taking. I was on a magic carpet ride of scotch. I had a lifelong love affair with scotch, and in the last 3 years I married vodka because I was living in the Virgin Islands, and you know, you could see through the glass. It didn't really require ice, and if any danger was coming, you could see it coming towards you. So it worked. It worked. But that said, I sometimes think that if I could have kept on drinking, I would have. I loved it that much. I loved it with all my heart. But it stopped working. For a period of time, I worked in Greece, in the country of Greece, where the national drink, as many of you may know, is ouzo. And they have a saying in Greece, one ouzo you drink, two ouzos drink each other, three ouzos drink you. And I just applied that to any other thing I was drinking, because eventually, as an alcoholic, every glass I picked up began to drink me. So I drank for 19 years, And that occasion in that January when I got alcoholic poisoning, I would love to tell you, was the first time. It was not. I just didn't know what it was called. And at that time, I still had no interest in not drinking. I think for so many of us, drinking is what we did. And I often think of my life when I started out, it was big. It was like a big picture. And alcohol, such as it was kind of around the edges, little things tucked in around the borders. And it was, for me, what I call situational. If the situation called for a drink, I would have one. But it was not required. And it certainly wasn't the way it was at the end of my drinking, when the picture was drinking. And whatever was left of my life and my relationships and my family and my values, such as they were stuck in around the edges, barely in the frame. And I had not noticed. I had failed to pay attention to what had happened to me. That is how alcohol, the rapacious creditor, had taken over everything that I cared about, that I knew, that I did. Thank you. And I wish I could stand here and say that I had a moment of blazing enlightenment and decided to put down a drink with the same dedication that I put down a pack of cigarettes. Oh, no. I went back from New York after the alcoholic poisoning to the Virgin Islands, and then I was aware that my life was skidding out of control. And I always have believed that God speaks to us in the voice that God knows we can hear. And in my case, it was, na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na, get a job, get a job. So my life was a complete disaster on every level, but the only thing I could think about was, if I went back to New York and got a job, everything would be all right. So back I came, and through the goodness of her heart, a sober woman who was a friend of my sister's, who was also sober, had agreed to help me try to get into her field, which was what I wanted to do. And do I need to tell you that after a few meetings with her, where I did not drink, I knew if I was going to meet with her, I'd have to wait to start my drinking until after we had had our meeting. I went to a party where she was. To this day, I have no idea what happened there because I was a blackout drinker. But I will tell you that the day after the party, she called me and she said, "Sarah, I do not know what I have ever done to merit the behavior you exhibited to me last night. But if you ever want to talk about that, you remind me of the way I was when I was drinking. And I hope you will call me." Click. And she hung up. And half of me thought, oh, doesn't she know what a hangover I've got? That was so unkind. And the other half of me knew it was done. Wouldn't need denial if we didn't have awareness. So I waited 2 days. I called her. She said, "Meet me for lunch." I remember thinking, Japanese restaurant, won't be able to have any Kirin beer, but I'll listen to her, because every food group was paired with whatever alcohol went with it. And if it was in the daytime, it probably wasn't going to be wine or hard liquor, but I would, even though I didn't drink beer except for Kirin beer or some kind of beer with a hamburger to cure a hangover. You know, that was how my life was organized. And I went to that lunch, and she told me her story. And she said to me, "Can you come with me to a meeting tomorrow?" And I said, "Oh, couldn't possibly. I'm getting a train. I'm going to a house party in Rhode Island." It was the summertime. And she looked at me across the table, and she said, "Do you think you can go away and not drink?" And I looked at her and I said, "What do you think I am, an alcoholic?" And the word just stuck in my mouth, because of course that's exactly what she thought, and it was exactly who I was. So I came back from that house party. I did not drink. I started going to meetings. I spent the first 5 years, which for me still is early sobriety, because it took me that long to have what I call recovery eye-hand coordination, to make sure that when I put out my hand at a party or some public place where they were serving alcohol, that I would not find a glass of vodka in it. So I practiced that over and over and over. And after about 5 years, I was reasonably certain that I probably would not pick up a drink at least that day. But I really had no idea how to live sober. And did I mention how arrogant and selfish and stuck up I was? That I also really refused to make any friends in AA. My attitude was, I'll go to your meetings, but I already have a great network, a great group of people, all of whom I love desperately. They were all drinkers, and you can't imagine how fast they disappeared. But in any event, I wanted what you had, but I did not really want to be one of you. So I held myself apart, and that played to the whole kind of way I had been brought up anyway, and it was extremely difficult for me on any real level to connect. For the first few years, I thought my job was to delight you with tales of my bottoming out in the Virgin Islands. And I came to see that that was just the rite of passage that brought me here, and to be grateful for every one of those drinks, especially my favorite at the end, which was called a Smith & Wesson. They had very inventive and creative drinks there. But after the first few years, it was evident to me through the steps, through being sponsored, through going to meetings all the time, which I loved, because since I wasn't going to be friends with any of you or have any phone numbers or call anybody except my sponsor, it was nice to kind of be in a room with all of you. So I began to see that I would need to change. Goethe says, everybody wants to be somebody. Nobody wants to grow. And I think of that a lot because for me, the great joy of my sobriety all these years has been the ways in which I have been able first to become aware of what is possible in terms of how I could change, and then to have the miraculous tools that we get here to be able to do it. So that takes me to a week ago Saturday. And a week ago Saturday, I was going to be in the city on the weekend, which I usually am not, and I was here for the memorial service of a beloved friend in AA who had died entirely too young, and that was happening on a Sunday. So on Saturday, I saw that there was a workshop downtown in my field being sponsored by arguably the preeminent guy in my field. And he was not going to be the speaker, but he was sponsoring someone who had written a book who was going to lead this seminar. And so I got up really early on Saturday morning, not my favorite thing to do. Usually I like to be drinking coffee with my sweetheart at that hour on Saturday morning, or maybe walking my dog. But no, I was downtown, armed with my notebook, my pen, my glasses, and so grateful when I got into the room, which probably had, you know, it was one of those amphitheater rounds of maybe 5 or 6 rows of built-in desks with chairs behind and not too much space to move around, but I had a great seat, a nice seat made, and believe it or not, they had delicious coffee, which I wasn't expecting. So here I am, all ready to go with my notebook and all my things laid out and my coffee, and the lights dimmed and the workshop leader came out, and it was the expectant hush when the door like that swung open and tardy, I was proud of myself that I was on time, came a woman eager to be there with every right, just like me, to be there, only she was late. She headed straight for my row, a huge duffel coat over one arm, a big bag over the other, went in front of me, and bingo, that cup of hot coffee filled to the brim all over me, my notebook, my glasses, the seat, everything. Now, You can imagine how I felt. I, who had gotten up out of bed, traversed Manhattan from one end to the other, only to sit there for what I was expecting was going to be an illuminating experience. And I was incensed. And in that moment, two amazing things happened. First, I thought, Sarah, you can sit here and burnish an enormous resentment for the next 3 hours and not get a single thing out of this seminar. Or you can do what you know how to do because you have learned it, you have heard it, you have listened to it, and you can turn this over. And you can bless this woman without adding any expletives or anything else. And you can pay attention and just be present. And the other amazing thing that happened was the outpouring of napkins from all around me. People I had not seen, people I had not said hello to, people who had no reason to be nice to me, gave up all their napkins from all their coffee and their little snacks and mopped me up. The kindness of strangers. And I thought, this is not an AA meeting, but I know how to accept this. Thank you. I know how to accept this because I learned that here. I learned how to accept what people will do for me, give me, offer to me, whether I ask for it or not, because I am open to that. And I learned about being open here. Because I, first of all, became willing to be open myself to other people. And I think for so many of us, it's so much easier to give than to take it in. So it took me a long time to be able to take it in. And I ended up having quite a nice time at that seminar. And when that same woman with all of her baggage went by me on the way out and said, sort of, absentmindedly, oh, are you the one And I refrained from saying anything. She said, I'm sorry. And I said, thank you. And just zipped the lip. Restraint of tongue and pen. Thank you, seventh step. And so this is a small little example of how I try every day to do what Bill was so committed to in the many years of his life after he started our amazing program, when he talked about emotional sobriety. He talked about, I was reading something today in the Language of the Heart, where he says something so sweet about sobriety wasn't as tough for him as this business of growing up. This business of growing up. And I've been around for a while. You can tell by looking at me and my recounting of life in the 50s that I have also been on this earth for quite a while. But this business of growing up and what we learn here about how to do that and how to be in this world in a way that not just makes me comfortable, but I think makes for comfort around me. That was nothing I ever thought about when I was drinking. I was just like so many of us described in the Big Book, like that tornado, just going through life, smashing anything that wasn't just in front of us, giving way. And I am so incredibly grateful that I don't need to live like that anymore. But not just that it was my idea, but that I learned that from all of you, and I have all of you to help me do that. And the other day in a meeting, someone said, you know, we live a day at a time, but I have never been sober in this day. So that keeps it fresh for me. What keeps it fresh for me is going to meetings, hearing all the day counts, thinking about all the people with 3 days and 14 days and 52 days and 89 days, and what an incredible adventure lies ahead. Not every day is great. Not every day is great. But every day I have a code to live by. And for the 19 years that I drank, that's what I searched for. That's what I wanted. That's what I drank for. To belong to something. To have a way to live. To have tools that would help me. So is it any wonder that on this Valentine's Day, I am so happy to be with all of you and so unabashedly in love with AA. Thank you. Thank you.